The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Rhode Island is the first state in the United States to give local communities the authority to establish safe consumption sites, also known as overdose prevention sites or harm reduction centers. Two organizations, Project Weber Renew and Kodak Behavioral Healthcare, have been selected to start up Rhode Island's first overdose prevention sites. I had the great good fortune recently to speak with Colleen Daly-Andoy, the executive director of Project Weber Renew. Here's that conversation.
So my name is Colleen Daly-Andoy. I'm the executive director of Project Weber Renew, and we are a harm reduction organization based in Providence, Rhode Island. So we are the largest harm reduction organization in the state. We serve around 6,000 people a year. We are a peer-based organization, so we provide services across the cities of Providence, Pawtucket, and Central Falls. Ranging from street outreach, case management, we operate two drop-in centers, and we have a stationary mobile unit in Kennedy Plaza, which is the largest bus hub in the state. And we provide a huge range of services, basic needs, case management, harm reduction supplies, obviously we're a syringe services provider, and then lots of support groups and connections to recovery for folks who are interested in it. So that's sort of the range of services that we provide.
Right up front, I got to tell you, I'm greatly honored having you on the show. I mean, the work your organization is doing, the work that you're about to embark on, the wisdom of your state's leaders, their intelligence, their courage. I mean, God, what a statement that doing the right thing, doing the smart thing takes courage, but you all have that in spades. Tell me more about this. What's going to happen? How is the site going to operate? The services you're going to, but what's going to be happening here?
Yeah. So first of all, I do want to also piggyback on what you said is that I am really proud of Rhode Island. I'm proud of our legislators who passed this law. I'm proud of our governor who signed it. I'm proud of all of the community leaders who made this happen. Many of my staff, many of our team, other community organizations that we work with for many years. So this is really exciting and we're incredibly proud and grateful. So just want to put that out there. But yes, we just signed a contract for $2.6 million from the opioid settlement, this opioid settlement dollars that the attorney general got from every state's been doing these opioid settlement sort of agreements. And so for Rhode Island, some of the dollars were designated specifically for somebody to open an overdose prevention center. So we signed that contract several weeks ago, and we are now in the process of the design and of thinking about, obviously city council approval, all of the sort of the administrative hurdles. We'll have to obviously train and hire and train staff and do the construction of the building and then opening hopefully early in 2024.
It is amazing. And so there are just a few concepts I want to ask you about. And you mentioned a moment ago, I think, and it kind of seems self-explanatory, but what is meant by peer counseling and mentoring?
So the folks who work for us, the majority are people who are either in long-term recovery or people who experienced incarceration, people who experience homelessness, people who are HIV positive, or people who have engaged in sex work or are continuing to engage in sex work. And so really the idea is that people can walk in the door and see somebody who really understands their lived experience, who understands their life stories and can really connect with them in a deeper way than a random social worker or a person with, many years of experience or education could potentially do.
That kind of personal connection, that kind of personal contact probably helps in building a rapport and building trust.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think that's the goal is really for people to see themselves in the staff. And then of course, our ultimate goal is for people who are clients or people who utilize our services to become staff. So we have several staff right now who are former clients, and really that's always the goal is for people to see that there is a pathway for them to become, a member of our team. And obviously many of those folks are the strongest and most powerful, members of the team.
That's brilliant. Now what's meant by low or no barrier services?
So we call low barrier services, services that really meet people where they are, which is one of the fundamentals of, you know, facets of harm reduction is really meeting people where they are. So for example, we have a clinical psychologist who's here once a week and provides services for clients that fit a certain profile. So it's a specific project. And she makes appointments with people. And if people miss the appointments, she will see them anyway. If people come an hour late, she will see them anyway. If people can only stay for 5 minutes, she'll see them. If people stay over their time, she'll see them. Just the idea is that you tailor services and you tailor your work to meet the needs of the person, as opposed to putting people into cookie cutter services that oftentimes will not actually meet their, you know, their real needs. So all of the services that we provide are really dedicated or, focused on trying to meet people's actual needs.
So, okay. Now this seems like a good segue. I was going to ask you about some of the concerns people raise about harm reduction centers, syringe service programs, overdose prevention sites. I'm going to ask you about I'll jump ahead and ask you one of these now. One of those things that we hear repeatedly is that centers provide services to people who use drugs without demanding that they first agree to enter a treatment program. So you're helping people without demanding that they sign up for some kind of a treatment thing. Can you speak to that?
Well, what we see is that mandated services or mandatory services or services that are forced are far less successful than voluntary services that people engage in when they are ready. And so, you know, folks who know recovery and know the process of recovery know that there is a stage of readiness for a person to engage in recovery, and they are much more likely to be successful in recovery if they are choosing that path as opposed to being forced. And what we do see with a lot of the mandatory services is that people are more likely to overdose. So when they're forced into treatment and they get out and they relapse and they use again, their tolerance is lower and they are, you know, they're overdosing at higher rates. So we really focus our efforts on meeting people where they are. So recognizing that when people are ready for change, when people are ready for recovery, when people are ready for treatment, we want to be there at that moment. But not the goal is not to force people, because we recognize that it isn't effective and it doesn't work. And research has obviously shown that.
And I mean, it seems to me that building up the trust and rapport with clients that you do, that would, I mean, if they do decide to seek help, you'd be the people they'd want to turn to first.
Right. And they know that we are not going to judge them. So that's the wonderful thing, is that people come in here for services, for harm reduction services, and they could come in for a day or for a year or for 5 years. And the day that they decide that they want to get into treatment, we will immediately take them. So we immediately transport people to treatment. But the key is also that if that person does relapse at some point in the future, we also want them to know that they are welcome to come back. So the idea is sort of, we're a non-judgmental place. We don't want people to feel like, I messed up, I can't come back. You can always come back. We always want to be there with open arms to let people know that, you know, you deserve to be safe. You deserve to be welcome. You deserve to be healthy, you know, in whatever you want for your life. We want to help people, support people in that way.
Just working to help people and save lives.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Now, there was an article published recently about the experiences of people who put together New York City's first legally authorized safe consumption sites, legally authorized locally, not by the state, very important. A couple of things in particular that they observed were of great importance that I want to ask you about. And the first one's political engagement. Now, your state legislature and governor took an important, courageous step to save lives by authorizing this program. And then because of pandemic delays, they had to step up again to extend the time limit for it. I mean, there is no doubt that drug warriors around the nation and all over the world are trying to pressure them into doing the wrong thing. And thankfully, they've resisted. Talk to me, if you could, about the political engagement that you've engaged in to make this program a reality.
Well, I think it's one of the benefits of Rhode Island being such a small state is that we really can have that one-on-one conversation with legislators. You know, legislators, it's a small body, it's a small sort of community. And so people do know each other, and we engage with legislators. And also, I think the legislators themselves are often directly affected or impacted by substance use disorder, by overdose. They've seen their friends, their family members die. Some of the champions of this legislation were people who had direct family members who had passed away. And they said, we have to try something different. And so I think that's really one of the keys is just, you know, that direct connection, which I think can be harder in larger states or in larger cities. It's not something that I necessarily think is kind of transferable to a state or a city like New York City, for example. So I think that's a challenge, but certainly I think that that direct personal connection and the stories of people who utilize the services or who would people, stories of people in recovery who, you know, can say, oh, I've had 29 overdoses, I've had 45 overdoses, and now I'm 10 years in recovery. And the idea is that if we had stopped after one or five or whatever, that person wouldn't be alive today and they wouldn't be doing the amazing work that they're doing. And that's, you know, like I said, that's several of our staff. So we always try to tell people those stories and really try and get them to understand the value of everybody's life.
So one of the other aspects that they noted in this article was about community engagement, engaging with, and that's obviously very important. I mean, really, it is vital, and that's, you know, whether you're in a large or small area, community is still community. Talk to me about that. What kind of work you're doing, and what, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we've done a lot of community engagement. And I think the benefit for us in some ways is that we have done a lot of work already in the communities. So we're, a lot of sort of the community does know us. And so they do know that we're an organization that is a member of the community where we're serving people that are their own family members and friends. And we provide services that we believe are also contributing to the positive, you know, to positivity in the community. So we do syringe cleanups, we do community events where we will give out Narcan, supermarkets, and talk to kids in schools about overdose prevention. And so I think we really try to use that message that, you know, we are serving a community that is that are your neighbors, that are your friends and family. And then we also, as, you know, an organization, are also your friends and family. So that's, you know, that's been our message, I think.
So, and of course, community and political engagement will continue to be important as this program rolls out and as it's implemented. Do you have any plans for engagement moving forward?
Yes, I mean, we're doing, we're doing the political engagement. We have been doing that for years, really, even to get the bill passed and then within the city. And then we're also doing sort of just the individual community engagement. So door knocking and community events. We have a cleanup plan for that neighborhood in about a month. And so, like I said, it's really just getting to know people, getting people to know us and our organization and what we do, and seeing that we are providing a service. What is what we really see is we're providing a service to a community, you know, that is hit by overdose, that is, you know, seeing public drug use, that is seeing syringes on the ground, and really all three of those things will be positively impacted by an overdose prevention center.
This is my conversation with Colleen Daly-Ndoye, Executive Director of Project Weber Renew. Project Weber Renew, along with Kodak Behavioral Healthcare, have been selected by the state of Rhode Island to open the first state-authorized legal overdose prevention sites in the country. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. One of the things about substance use in general, and about, there's a great deal of stigma, in fact, in people's attitudes. You've had to overcome quite a lot of that in order to get this approved, in order to get this project underway. Stigma can also be internalized. I mean, you can only take so long of being called names before you start to think, well, maybe, you know, I mean, if we know that bullying is, you know, whether it's parents or peers, it can take a toll. From what I understand, from looking at experiences in other places, in Vancouver, at the Overdose Prevention Society and others, and around the world, really. There's so many of these around the world. They have a real way of helping to build community within, you know, among people who use drugs and people with lived and living experience. Can you talk to me a bit about that, the kind of community building that goes on?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we see our spaces and our staff as representatives of sort of the community. So for example, we allow community organizations to use our spaces whenever they want to host an event or whenever so the spaces are empty on the weekends. So we allow people, we have a community fridge outside our drop-in center where people, anyone can come by and access that community fridge. During COVID, we started to expand really we were one of the few organizations that were really out on the streets, staying out on the streets. And we started doing more and more basic needs. And so we were suddenly just, getting 1,000 meals and just doing, driving around and distributing 1,000 meals to folks. And of course, all of our services are completely voluntary. There's no payment, there's no nothing. And so it's really just whoever needs that food gets the food. There's not sort of a means test or anything like that. And so I think, yeah, seeing people's needs beyond simply harm reduction. So seeing people's basic need, the clothing, the food, I think it builds community because people tend to sort of engage in that level. So if they have a restaurant, they donate to us and, we will distribute the food to the folks that we serve. If they, have clothing that they have winter jackets that we give them out to the folks we serve. There's a sense of everyone being in it together, which I think is really, it just makes me feel very proud of the small community, that we do have.
During debates over safe consumption sites, also over syringe service programs, and actually, we hear this stuff about treatment programs too, especially methadone. people have encountered difficulty just finding sites for programs, because concerns get raised about public safety, about crime, about needle litter. Can you speak to those? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely sort of try to, especially with an overdose prevention center where a lot of people's complaints are about public usage and about syringe litter, I try to explain that actually this is a method to reduce those things. So, if people are using inside, there will be, less public usage and there will be less syringe litter, which they've seen in the New York site and all around the world. So, we share that with people. But also I think we are lucky in that the site that we are opening is in an area which is an overdose hotspot, but it is in a sort of unique space where there are no residential neighbors. So it's surrounded by a highway on one side and a train track on the other and a scrapyard on one side and a used car dealer on the other. So it's kind of in an ideal location for a service that it is highly stigmatized, even though we recognize that these are members of our community and that this is a service that will save lives in the community, and so I think it's unnecessarily stigmatized, but for being the first, we are obviously we're trying to sort of I guess you could say the path of least resistance to open in a facility or in an area that's both an overdose hotspot and also does not have any direct residential neighbors.
Of course, unfortunately, the downside is that by being in a spot in that kind of location, you're probably going to be blamed for the condition of that location. Even before you move in, you'll be blamed for the location of that. It's just sort of the way that works.
Well, sorry, the good news about the location. No. The location is actually currently a medication assisted treatment facility, and it's been there for decades. So that's actually kind of wonderful, is that it is already providing services to people with substance use disorder, and they are going to be moving. So it's kind of a we view it as really great timing.
Literally, a place some people will already be familiar with.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, there are efforts ongoing in several other states to pass a law modeled after Rhode Island's. There's a hearing on a bill just recently before a legislative committee in Maine. In fact, covered that on this show. There was another in Colorado. I covered that one, too. Do you have advice for people around the country who are hoping to save lives in their states and are looking at Rhode Island, Rhode Island's example for inspiration?
I would definitely say that, obviously, engaging community support and engaging with folks who are currently impacted by the overdose crisis and by substance use disorder is really important. And so sort of really engaging with folks on the ground who are working on this issue. I would say, obviously, the one-on-one conversations are critical. So, you know, people are making decisions oftentimes based on politics. They don't even really understand the sort of the nuances or really what's going to happen at these sites. They sort of hear buzzwords and then they make these rash decisions. And so really being able to sort of decouple the, you know, which is of course extremely difficult, but sort of take the politics out of it and really just say, this is what the site is going to do. This is, you know, again, I think the Rhode Island example, you know, we it's a pilot. And so what we believe and what we know is going to happen is that we will open, people's lives will be saved, and then they will change it from a pilot to a, you know, a permanent law. And so, but I mean, if that's what it takes to sort of to get people to try this as an option, then try a pilot, say, we'll do it for 2 years. If we save lives, if we save, which we know also it saves enormous amounts of money, it saves money in EMS runs, it saves, you know, millions of dollars, saves a lot of money in medical care, just because obviously we're going to have a doctor on site who will be able to provide wound care. We see with xylazine and, you know, lots of wounds becoming really serious, people being in the hospital for days, weeks on end, costing hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars. And those infections and those wounds can be prevented, you know, if you are able to catch them soon enough. So it's just the savings in terms of cost. You sort of have to talk to people how they are motivated. If they're motivated by the money, talk to them about that this will save money. If they're motivated by saving human lives, which of course we hope everybody would be, then talk to them about that. But, you know, it's really, I think you have to sort of meet people where they are and figure out what actually, you know, will change their mind.
Yeah, just inspiring. You mentioning xylazine reminds me, will you be able to provide drug checking services at the site? Yeah. Or do you are?
Yes, we will. Yes. Yep. We're partnering with Brown to get a drug checking machine, which is wonderful. We have one once a week in our Pawtucket site. But yes, we will have drug checking capability. Yeah.
Oh, so you will be able to partner with Brown. Now people in place. Oh gosh.
Brandon, People, Place, and Health Collective.
People,
yes.
Place, and Health Collective. Brandon, yes. Marshall, I had yes. him on the show not long ago too. They will be partnering with you to do research on the site. Is that correct?
Yes. They are doing research. They are leading our evaluation for the site. Yes. Very exciting. We really love to work with them. They've been a great partner.
It always feels a little frustrating and more than just a little unfair that we decades of experience and research, I mean stacks of research, countless papers, all proving the efficacy of efforts like an overdose prevention site. It's overwhelming, and yet we still get the well, how do we know it's going to work? And yet, we know that the other way doesn't, and I've never seen the other side produce any research to show that the drug war works.
Right.
Again, another silly aside. So now we're at that point. What have I not yet asked that I should?
I mean, I think it's pretty comprehensive. What you've just gone through it all. I mean, I think the most important thing is obviously that we are excited to open so we can save lives. I mean, that is what we've all been working for many years, but over the last, especially 9 months, we've all been working around the clock, and it is just so that we can open and have that first person utilize the services and know that, you know, perhaps that person would not be alive if it wasn't for the work of all the folks who are doing this. And we, like I said, everyone deserves that chance at life. And so we're really very excited and very grateful to everybody who's, you know, helped us get to this point.
Now, that insistence on continuing to prove the flaming obvious and already proven by countless research articles. Anyway, this push to prove is one of the reasons why you have this is actually a pilot. The legislation has it as a pilot project, so it has a limited lifespan of only a few years. Am I correct on that? When will you have
to? That is correct. Yes.
Yeah, so you'll have
2 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So hopefully in 2 years they renew it or just make it permanent.
That would be the goal, is to make it permanent. And I, you know, I feel confident because I, like you said, there's so much research. There's so many decades of research. It's really overwhelmingly obvious, but every state feels like, oh, we're a special case. And we, you know, what worked in Canada and here and there and, you know, around the whole world, it's not going to work here, but we know that that's not true. We know that it will work. And obviously we've seen New York and, you know, I think they're at 800 overdoses reversed or something, some like huge number. And it's so exciting to see that. And so, you know, we're just so excited to see what they're doing and they're working with us on our technical assistance. Yeah, we're grateful to them for leading the way, really.
Now, how can people keep up with and support the work that you're doing? You have a website, what are your social media handles, that sort of thing?
Yes. So our website is just webrenew.org, webrenew.org. And all of our handles are this: Twitter at webrenew, Facebook, Instagram at webrenew. So it's pretty simple. We definitely try to keep the community updated as to what's happening and sort of the work that we're doing. And we welcome, of course, donations. I mean, we're a nonprofit, so if people want to donate, they can go to our website. We always are grateful for that.
Again, folks, we're speaking with Colleen Daly Ndoy, Executive Director of Project Weber Renew in Rhode Island. Project Weber Renew and another organization, Kodak Behavioral Healthcare. That's Kodak, CODAC, for anybody my age. Kodak Behavioral Healthcare. They've both been chosen to open the first legal, state-authorized overdose prevention sites in the United States. And I should, before I forget, I should, full disclosure, I signed up recently to become a monthly donor. It's only a little bit, but every little helps, you know.
Thank you so much. That really, we really appreciate that. And absolutely, every little bit helps. We are grateful for anybody who obviously can contribute, and no amount is too small. So thank you so much, Doug.
Colleen, you and your colleagues are doing God's work. I am so grateful to you for it. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Doug.
That was my conversation with Colleen Daly Ndoy, Executive Director of Project Weber Renew. Project Weber Renew, along with Kodak Behavioral Healthcare, has been chosen by the state of Rhode Island to open the first state-authorized legal overdose prevention sites in the country. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.